Tagatoy and my mother had been friends all my mother's life, and Tagatoy was not interested in being honored in the house she considered her second home. She simply came in, climbed onto one of her special couches, and called me over to keep her warm. It was impossible to be formal with her while lying against her and hearing her complain, as usual, that I was too skinny.
And for me, it was very, very strong. And I just remember when you start to read the Isha, one music that I really like it, that it's a kind of samba, that is something around this. Yes, I will sing a little bit for you. It's Foram me chamar, eu estou aqui, o que que há? Foram me chamar, eu estou aqui, o que que há? Eu vim de lá, pequenininho. Mas eu vim de lá, pequenininho. Alguém me avisou pra pisar nesse chão devagarinho. Alguém me avisou pra pisar nesse chão devagarinho. This music, it's around a born in child and how you start something. It's something that you're when it's around, of course, candomblé and this Afro-diasporic religion and culture, and it's when someone is coming and tell you called me, I am here, what is happening? And I came from there very little, and someone told me that I need to start very slowly. You know, like, it's just, I'm here, but I know that I need to come very slowly only to feel it. And but when the music starts, it's very dancing music. It's very good to hear and to dance. And after that, after this phrase, the woman tells that it's impossible to be stopped with samba. It's not easy to start very slowly with this. Someone told me that I need to start little, but I can't. It's impossible for me. For me, it's around the movement of the body. And for me, Blood Child was very, very sexy text, because it was very juicy, very, I don't know. I almost could feel and see everything that I sent it to you. And it's not only, when I say sexy, it's not only with around the sexuality of act, of the sex act, but how these erotic things can move us, how you can feel around this. And it's very funny, because now in Corona times, when we got this virus, you cannot smell or taste anything most of the time. And for me, it was my biggest fear around this fire was stop to smell it and to feel the taste more than die. Because for me it was like, oh my gosh, stop to with so many things that it's around me, because smelling and tasting is around thinking too. And this is kind of sexy, or maybe I can change erotic way of thinking. Because my body as a black, from Brazil, dark woman was very sexualized since I was a kid. So understanding this as a kind of movement, and then understanding how can be protected with this, was a very dancing exercises to do. And I always say that this made me think around one intellectuality that we can call it Jinga, which is a Yoruba word, that is very connected with the person who dance and fight. When you have Jinga, you're not fighting and just fighting, and you're not just dancing. It's something that need to be connected. It's a movement, very sexy movement, that make you stronger. You need to be muscles and intellectuality together to understand what is Jenga. This is something that is around the kind of language that I can bring with my work as intellectual, as a creator. And that's why I put in my bio that I have this heritage from natives, Indians, indigenous people, and the Afro-diasporic. And for me, this is very strong because I am not an African body. I'm an Afro-diasporic body. Which means that this possibilities of to bring me here now together, it's around suffering, it's around dying and killing, but understanding how can bring life around this. That's why I'm here, because my ancestors was working around life, even at the structure made they die or be killed or raped or murder or, you know, history.
I think this is so beautiful, though, the way you're talking about this, because in a way, what I was really struck by when we first read Blood Child together, you know, because Octavia Butler was sort of inspired to write this story based on hearing about this certain kind of parasite that would lay its eggs, you know, in the afterwards of Blood Child, she talks about this, that lays its eggs in the body, and she sort of had such a phobia of it that she did sort of a kind of investigation of it. And then from there wrote this story. And so from this opening passage, we hear, you know, it's something, you know, there's very slow and something very languorous about Tegatoy and how she's lying there. And you don't know what this egg is that that she's eating and the mother's not eating. And you find out that it's related to some kind of fecundity or some kind of fertility. And then you later find out is that this other host uses the bodies of the males, not the females, of humans, of Terrans, to lay eggs into. And so basically the life of a man who agrees to eat these eggs is that of a host, like it as becomes pregnant with some other species child. And so for Butler, this was a way for her to gain a kind of reconcile herself with this monstrosity. But you, Kena, thought it was very sexy. And yeah. I think this is beautiful. I just want to read one more further passage from this. And then sort of ask you, because you brought up such a beautiful archive of songs and music, and it must be interesting 6 months later to revisit these songs and music and images and colors. But I'll read one more passage and then ask you if you're thinking of some new colors and new songs that have come up. So this is the next paragraph. So there they are, you know, they're lying there. So Tegatoy has come over. They're all sitting in the living room. And then she's complaining that the narrator's too thin. And then she says, "You're better," she said this time, probing me with 6 or 7 of her limbs. "You're gaining weight finally. Thinness is dangerous." The probing changed subtly, becoming a series of caresses. "He's still too thin," my mother said sharply. Tegatoy lifted her head and perhaps a meter of her body off the couch, as though she was sitting up. She looked at my mother, and my mother, her face lined and old-looking, looked away. "Lian, I would like you to have what's left of Gan's egg." "The eggs are for the children," my mother said. "They are for the family." Unwillingly disobedient, my mother took it from me and put it to her mouth. There are only a few drops left in the now shrunken elastic shell. But she squeezed them out, swallowed them, and after a few moments, some of the lines of tension began to smooth from her face. "It's good," she whispered. "Sometimes I forgot how good it is." I just think that before you jump in, Ken, I think that there's something about this sort of intermixing of violence and pleasure that is so tied in with what you were saying about where you feel you're from and this intermixing of like these histories that have been told around rape and violence, but then also this kind of staking of a claim on joy and pleasure, right? Amidst that, as opposed to just letting that be the end of the narrative.
Yes, but we need to understand that sometimes it's not in the kind of psychologic way. You know, it's not around the pain is something good, it's around the sickness, and then, but we have around more possibilities to build this kind of thinking. And when you're reading again that part, I just start to remember one legend, not a history, a child history, that Mary and John and the witch that give the food, and the mother say, still, it's not so fat now, wait, it's not time to eat day now, you know, like, and I just remember this. But yes, it's important. That's why I like to say, I put in my email signs that I'm a love researcher, to understanding this kind of use of this word. And around this specific word, I start to research around how old can be this kind of use, understanding how our bodies can understand love. Beside of Eurocentric way, that love romantic, that you can die for your love and you can kill for your love and you can, oh my gosh, for your love. And love and care is very strong words around our history of colonialism. And how can I, and I start to think, how can I feel that as an Afro and Native, Afro-diasporic and Native body? How can I can understand these Eurocentric feelings inside of this body that makes me dead, be killed? And so I was trying to research another ways to understanding this kind of connection with the world, with the people. And I find it an Amharic, which is the a language from Ethiopia, Amharic, and is the country and the probably the language of Queen of Saba, which is the very strong woman in the Bible, and is black. So it's very connected with the story of my family. Me and my sister really love the Queen of Saba. Well, my sister bring Queen of Saba for me. And I start to understand. And in Amharic is a very, very, very old language. One of the most still we use is still. So the word fikirih, I'm sorry if I say it wrong, but it's, how can I say it? Fikirih is this oldest love, this used love, this frequently translated, and I'm a part of this translated body that inside of me have so many languages and so many ways to live. And that's why I'm more a fikir researcher than love researcher. Maybe a traditional older love. And this kind of love, I can understand there's something that can bring the feeling and the practice of the violence without taking out the kind of love. We have many interpretation and stories around how the Orishas let us African bodies came from Europe, came from Africa, came from many countries in Africa to Europe and America, and how the Orishas let this happen. And this one history around the Eshu, the very special Orisha, that was inside, the Eshu was inside of these boats, to understanding how this connection can be strong. how this kind of feeling and understanding can be bigger living this continent. And it's not around why they let us die, no, but how they bring to another intelligence, these kind of intelligences. Of course, this when you listen this in a romantic way, you say, oh, so you're saying the slavery was good. No, I'm not saying this. But I'm the product of the slavery, and I need to understand how the violence, I can stop knowing this, and how can I name it this? How can I I understand my movements being less a white European and deaf movements? And this kind of jinga, this kind of thinking is something that brings me.
Keina, this brings me to another question, and perhaps more of a comment. That is that when Aisha was reading Butler now, and then kind of going through our previous conversations around it, there is this sort of ambiguity, if we want to put it somehow, between joy and suffering, right? Somehow, right? Like so the joy and suffering also brings me to think on coloniality. Like, how is that joy and suffering are two kind of existential places that entangles the colonial subject, like in this case, indigenous, mestizos, and so on. So I was, and then like thinking in Central America, the African diaspora, but also what we call, for instance, in Guatemala, mestizos, right? That are, to put it broadly, the mix between indigenous blood, Mayan to this case, and Spanish. The word in Maya Quiche for a mestizo that denied its indigenous descendants is Kashlan. And Kashlan, it's somebody thinking of what you were saying, that somehow denies joy and just assumes suffering. You know, because the Kashlan, in this case the mestizo, lives all the time denying its colonial indigenous past while also not being European. You know what I mean? So, so I just find very powerful the idea of thinking on the entanglement between joy and suffering as something that we can assume, like as a force, right? And as a creative force. And it is a little bit of what I think you do when you think in these terms, right? It is not like it is not love for love or sensuality for sensuality, but that allows us to think on ourselves in a different way, and to think in mestizaje, in African diasporas, in a different way. So I just found that thought very moving and beautiful to think in all of this.
When I realized that, okay, of course I'm anti-racist, but what I'm doing around this? Of course I'm feminist, what I'm doing around this, and how this be connected, how can this be connected with my doing, my working, and named some kind of why I am in love. It's always around that. Why I'm in love with this kind of person, this kind of doing. Why I'm doing the work, I'm working with art. Because when I say that I research natives, indigenous, intelligence, intellectualities, knowings, and say the word art, sometimes this doesn't make sense. Because what I think in is art is European way of thinking. Sometimes when I'm going to talk with a Guarani intellectual, well, what you are talking around, some we don't know, museum, cultural center, you need a house to put something that is very important. Why do you need this kind of architecture to put this together? And understanding this kind of limits that we have, and we can in with our body, with our mestizos, with our Afro diasporic bodies, we can understand in our breathing that we can expand these limits. When Aisha told that very sex behavior around Tegatoy, that wants come here to, because I like you warm. It, for me, it's something, oh my God. All right. You know, like I started to try to find the color or the shape of Tegatoy and understanding how can not only the power around this being, because Tegatoy is something very, someone or something very strong and powerful in this way of living there too, but understanding how this could happen and make this, how can bring abundance in this kind of relationship? Because this movement, this kind of intelligence was the intellectuality that we have been colony, working in abundance in a dying work, in the slavery, in the, around death. How can you understand how can we can get the abundance in the death movement? Because we want to keep going, we want to more. It's not only around suffering. This kind of only suffering way of thinking is very romantic, it's very Eurocentric, it's very German way, it's very Freudian. And but I'm not saying that it's wrong, but it's limited.
I agree with you. I think that's a beautiful way of putting it. And one of the things you see in Blood Child is how the story, like the arc of the story, because what the narrator sees is the process of someone having the eggs taken out of him and how violent it is. And at the end, first he says, okay, no, take my sister. And at the end he says, no, take me. And the description of that, because he knows what his life is going to be of being sort of tied to this host, right? To being a kind of host of these eggs. And he says the small amount of fluid, when he finally lays with her, it's a very sexual metaphor, he says, the small amount of fluid that came into me with her egg relaxed me as completely as a sterile egg would have. So I could remember the rifle in my hands and my feeling of fear and revulsion, anger and despair. I could remember the feelings of reviving them. I could talk about them. But I want to move on to sort of thinking about something else you were talking, because I think that sort of way in which he goes with his eyes open, knowing what he's going into, but then as it goes on, you sort of hear the pleasure of him laying with her, which is in a way his first sexual experience, but you know, this is the moment he's getting impregnated. But I want to turn to something else that you have talked about, which is the ocean and the Orishas. And I'm thinking a little bit about the three of us and how we described ourselves all in terms of brownness. And if you could see us, you realize that we inhabit very interlinked but very different kinds of brownness, you know? Pablo very beautifully talked about indigenous issues. Kena, you talked about sort of what it means to you to be like from the African diaspora, Afro diaspora, and what that means in terms of displacement. But what brings us all together is the ocean. And, you know, where my ancestors are from, which is the South Asian continent via Persia and elsewhere. But one of the sort of ways in which water is described is called Kala Pani, which translates to black water. I mean, but I'm just thinking about this, you know, because I think that, you know, so much we've thought about the Atlantic and how these big boats were crossing the Atlantic, these, you know, sort of plundering and from Europe. And then the Indian Ocean has such a different history, which is a travel of these very small boats called dhows, that because of the trade winds, because of the ocean currents, went all the way from East Africa to Indonesia, you know, in these tiny boats, and yes, all the trade and the mixing of people. But also just thinking about the sort of contrast between what, you know, say people call the, you know, the Black Atlantic and Kalapani, you know, Kala meaning black as well, you know, and so black water, Black Atlantic. But sort of thinking about this as a darker side, but I wanted to sort of jump us actually to another part of thinking about this relationship between joy and pain and joy and sun and sky and the sea. I was thinking about another passage from Parables of the Sower, because we have, in a way, sort of, we went from this very sexy text to this text that is really marked by a lot of suffering. Uh-huh. But I wanted to actually bring us back to this one passage that where they visit the ocean for the first time, and read a little bit of that to you, to sort of remember these very beautiful moments and these idea of someone who's grown up in this orchard of beautiful fruits and scarcity outside the walls, but who's never seen the sea. And I was wondering, could I read this out and then see what you think? Yeah?
Great.
Okay. Thursday, August 5th, 2027. Late today, we came within sight of the ocean. None of us had seen it before, and we had to go closer, look at it, camp within sight and sound and smell of it. Once we had decided to do that, we walked shoeless into the waves, pant legs rolled up. Sometimes we just stood and stared at it, the Pacific Ocean, the largest, deepest body of water on Earth, almost half a world of water. Yet as it was, we couldn't drink any of it. Harry stripped down to his underwear and waded out until the cool water reached his chest. He can't swim, of course. None of us can swim. We've never before seen water enough to swim in. Zara and I watched Harry with a lot of concern. Neither of us felt free to follow him. I'm supposed to be a man, and Zara attracts enough of the wrong kind of attention with all her clothes on. We decided to wait until after sundown and just go in fully clothed to wash away some of the grime and stink. Then we could change clothes. We both had soap and we were both eager to make use of it. There were other people on the beach. In fact, the narrow strip of sand was crowded with people, though they managed to stay out of each other's way. They had spread themselves out and seemed far more tolerant of one another than they had during our night in the hills. I didn't hear any shooting or fighting. There were no dogs, no obvious thefts, no rape. Perhaps the sea and the cool breeze lulled them. Harry wasn't the only one to strip down and go into the water. Quite a few women had gone out wearing almost nothing. Maybe this was a safer place than any we'd seen so far.
Wow, so nice. Octavia have this kind of writing that is so dancing writing, I don't know, maybe smelling writing. The first thing that I think around Octavia is something around movies, but have limits of this movie, because we don't have the smell, the taste. You don't have the warm that sometimes bring these words. And that's okay. I like to talk around limits, but it's very interesting how can we can be connected with this. Because sometimes it's a kind of memory, and then sometimes it's something that brings us something new, you know, like. And then, of course, I really want to dance these words.
There's something about the water, you know, because up till then we read